Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Everyone, I'm 1010 Win Sports Director Mark Renee. This is On the Mark, where we take a look at the stories behind the stories in the world of sports. And this ought to be a fun one. Our guest today is Gabby Dabrowski. She is in the top 10 in the world of women's doubles in professional tennis, had a breakout 2019, and is hoping for better things even in 2020 if we can get tennis back on track. She is one of the top ranked players in Canada, and is a phenomenal follow on social media. GABYDABROWSKI. Gabby Dabrowski, thanks so much for joining me. How are you, and how have you been coping with things lately?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm good. I've been coping really well, actually, so no complaints from my end so far.
I saw you were out on the tennis court not terribly long ago, and you looked pretty gassed. Was that just because of a particularly strenuous session?
Well, I hadn't hit in over a month. And so my best friend and I, we played some tennis like a week ago on the Sunday. And she hadn't played in over 2 years. And so she stopped playing tennis in her early 20s. She's 27 now, so we joke that she came out of retirement to hit with me. But no, it's just, you know, in Florida, it's so hot and humid now. So we were dead.
Wow. Let me ask you, since you are in Florida and it has become one of the COVID-19 hotspots of late, how safe, how secure, how comfortable do you feel playing tennis, even with a friend?
Well, I actually just today flew to Boston area in Massachusetts, but I was in Florida ever since Indian Wells was canceled in early March. So it was probably the longest amount of time that I'd actually not been traveling around since I was probably a teenager or maybe even younger. So where we were at Saddlebrook, you know, it's part of the suburbs outside of Tampa, and it felt very, very safe. I was staying with my friends, and it's like a gated community, and Saddlebrook's a beautiful resort. They have golf and tennis and fitness, and so I was still able to keep up with my fitness. For the first 2 months, we did like almost pretty much 99% of our workouts outside in the field that we've got. Lots of body weight workouts. We got to use some weights and clean them after. And everybody was kind of, you know, most of the people that were part of that group, they live in Saddlebrook. So it was just like our own little bubble. So I felt very, very safe. I thought the facilities were amazing, and they took such good care of us, as well as making sure that we felt like everything was clean and, that they were really paying attention to what was going on. So I felt very comfortable there.
So how much different, if you don't mind me asking, and I'm sorry to cut you off. I do that, and I hate when other people do. How much different was it playing under these circumstances than usual?
Playing tennis, you mean?
Yes.
No different. For me, it was no different. Honestly, we weren't doing the whole use your own tennis ball thing. I think that's overrated. I don't think it makes a difference based on the science that I've heard, to use your own tennis ball or not use your own tennis ball. I think tennis is one of the safest sports to be playing, actually, during this time. I think people should get out there and play. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. you know, maybe don't hug your partner at the end, but playing normally is totally fine.
Well, it's funny, you know, here in the New York area, there are places that have been open pretty much since the weather turned for the better. So maybe April. But a lot of places have been, as you say, you know, use your own balls, don't hug your partner, really no fraternizing, you know, before or after matches, just get on, get off. Separate sets of tennis balls in use. And one of the other things is a lot of places have restricted players to only playing singles. And I know you're not only a top doubles player, but you are one of the biggest doubles proponents on the planet. You know, you've been on my radar since you won the Connecticut Open up in New Haven a few years ago. But your resume sports quarterfinal appearances or better at all of the four majors. Quarterfinalist last year at the U.S. Open. You were the runner-up in women's doubles at Wimbledon last year after reaching the semifinals a year ago. I saw the comments and the long thread of comments on Twitter after Marion Bartoli's comments around Memorial Day. And even when the U.S. Open last week announced that they would be going on as scheduled, you had a multi-point rebuttal to the USTA and to the world about how protective you are about doubles.
Yeah, so, well, I'll say this. So last year, my sort of interest, deepening interest in tennis and how it was governed began when the ITF actually changed their entry rules, and hundreds, if not potentially thousands, of tennis players were ostracized from playing professional events and building up their ranking. So it was actually like a year and a few months ago where I started to kind of want to learn what was going on behind the scenes, whereas before I just kind of showed up and played and didn't really think about much else. So I did a lot of research on my own. I had meetings with the ITF, tried to make things better. Luckily, they reversed their decision on the rules so that more people could play and become professional, which was great. But then, you know, because of that, you know, new connections pop up, new friendships were made, and then started thinking, well, how else can I make a positive impact on tennis? And was talking to different people, some of my fellow players, and they thought maybe I should run for player council. And on the WTA council, the way it works is you don't have a designated doubles spot just for a doubles player. On the ATP side, you do. You have two of them. And so it was important that I be elected, because on the WTA player council for many years, we haven't had any strong doubles advocates. So that was a passion of mine. And then luckily enough, my fellow opponents were kind enough to elect me and put their trust in me that I would represent them well and be their voice. And it wasn't just also about doubles. It was also about lower ranked singles players, you know, making sure that the qualifiers were going to be taken care of. So then it just kind of moved forward. And then we got super busy this year with the forest fires, the bushfires in Australia. So we were busy straight from January until now. We have meetings almost every week, sometimes multiple times a week. We're in contact with each other on council, like almost every day. And so I've just been learning a lot about what happens behind the scenes, the business side. And I just think it's really important that, you know, the players aren't always, and I don't mean a few players, but the majority of players, you know, to not sort of consistently get the short end of the stick on a lot of the deals that go on and different things that happen. So that's why I became vocal on a couple of things, because I have a bit more background knowledge in things that are going on. So I'm not, you know, just shooting from the hip, right, and I'm not just trying to complain. I'm actually thinking of solutions, you know, and I want to talk to people who are solution oriented. I'm not interested in just focusing on the negative. So I'm passionate about promoting doubles and it gaining more exposure long term. You know, right now the popularity is not where I'd like it to be, but I think there's a big market that hasn't yet been tapped into, at least, you know, I'd say 75% of recreational tennis players play doubles.
Right. That's where I was going to go next. So, it's right. There's so many people who don't even play singles because of one reason or another.
Yeah.
Recreationally in the United States and I'm sure Canada and around the globe is the same. You're playing mostly doubles. And it's always struck me as odd that the doubles competition doesn't really get the, I don't want to say respect, but it doesn't get the as bright a spotlight as the singles. And certainly here in the States, you know, the Bryan brothers and before them, you know, there have been, you know, other tandems who've come along. Obviously when Venus and Serena team up, that's, you know, always a big headline attraction, but they've been so few and far between. And I think that's, you know, to the detriment of the sport. And I'm guessing you agree.
Yeah. I just think it's, you can't necessarily compare singles and doubles. Like to me, they're just put simply different games. They're different games. It's still tennis, but it's like a unique aspect that tennis has and a very unique dynamic that you can have with a partner on the court. Yes, tennis is an individual sport, but at the same time, I've always believed that playing doubles, especially for young kids, teaches them like way better life skills than singles does, because singles is all about basic, which is good too, to have, you know, individual resilience and kind of being your own hero out there. But then doubles is more like, this is what you're going to have to do in the workforce and, right, you know, whatever endeavor you pursue. You need to learn how to communicate. You need to learn how to be on a team. You need to learn how to problem solve when somebody else isn't feeling their best or when you're not feeling your best. How do you deal with that with, you know, a partner alongside you? There are all these things. And I feel like those are more pertinent to real life. And so I would encourage, you know, anybody who's got a kid in tennis to put them in doubles early, because then the earlier they learn these skills, I think the better off they'll be later in life.
I could not agree more. When you heard last week, the USTA announced that the Open will go on as scheduled August 31st until the middle of September. And even before that, the Western and Southern Open, usually played in Cincinnati, is going to be the preview tournament, if you will, in place of the U.S. Open qualifying at Flushing Meadows with no fans in the stands and sort of a bubble environment. What were your thoughts, please?
Well, I had many, many thoughts and many concerns, and I still do. So, you know, I recently reached out to the player group that I represent, and I got a lot of feedback, and I, you know, I felt it's like my duty to pass it along and make sure that their voices are heard amongst all, you know, the chaos going on and just the business side of things, where it's like purely for monetary purposes, does a tournament want to move forward? And I totally get that, because if they, you know, make enough money off of the tournament, then that helps tennis long term, hopefully. You know, it goes into the grassroots programs and right, all the, you know, coaching and educational programs and all this sort of stuff, right? So I definitely understand the intention and the motivation behind operating. Like I genuinely do. But at the same time, like for me, something that's really interesting that I think will come out this week is, you know, 2 weeks ago, the USTA was adamant that we only have a plus one, which means one person on our team, whether that be a parent or a coach or a physio, you just choose one and you can only have one. Right. And the reasoning behind that was numbers, that to propose the US Open plan to, you know, the governor, we had to limit the amount of people that would be coming on site. And then lots of top players felt that that wouldn't be fair because they're so used to traveling with a team and an entourage and, you know, everybody there supporting them and stuff like that, which is fine. That's their prerogative. You know, do I wish that the top players would have paid more attention to the fact that the doubles draw was cut in half, there was no mixed, and that there was no qualies? Sure. But I get that they have their own priorities, so that's all right. But then you hear the USTA then maybe reconsidering the plus one, because obviously they want the top players to play. That's, you know, they're the stars of the show, which is great. But if you're gonna tell me that it's a numbers issue, then how increasing the numbers like by a plus two or a plus three, then I'm thinking, couldn't we have had qualies? Couldn't we have had a bigger doubles draw? Why, you know, so I'm a little bit concerned about the hypocrisy behind a decision like that. So I'm really curious as to see if the USTA will move forward with that, because I think that would be really unfair. And, you know, from the player side, we gave a lot of feedback, and I would say at least half of us, if not more, are extremely concerned to be traveling to New York, which was, you know, such a hotbed for COVID. And the fact that one of the stadiums was a hospital, and, you know, players are like, I'm just not sure. Like, I'm feeling really skeptical that an event like this can move forward, you know, with all these restrictions and precautions in place. Like, is it really about player safety, or is it about having the event at any cost, you know, because the cost of testing positive is extremely significant. You know, you get immediately withdrawn, whatever round you're in, and you have to stay in a hotel until you test negative. And right now the tests are not even 100% accurate. They're hoping that they will be in 2 months' time, which they might be, which would be good. But as it stands right now, the tests are not 100% accurate. So how do you pull somebody out of a draw if they've tested positive when you're not even sure if they're actually positive, you know? So there are a lot of like sort of different elements that need to be looked at, in my opinion, to make this event as fair as possible. And then now, you know, we're learning also that even wheelchair tennis was not considered in the discussion, which I didn't even know. And, you know, Dylan Alcott, who I believe is number one in wheelchair tennis right now, spoke out, and rightfully so. And now they're looking to reconsider wheelchair tennis because, you know, it looks really bad if they've forgotten about that.
Right.
So all these things. And I'm just thinking, like, what other changes could they have made that would have helped to accommodate more players? You know, could qualifying have been held 2 weeks prior in a different city in the US, and then could only have the qualifiers come to New York, which maybe would have been 20, 30 athletes, you know, not big numbers to necessarily negatively affect their bubble or anything like that. So there are just lots of things that I wish would have been considered stronger, I guess. And there's still a lot of questions that need answering, and there's just a lot of uncertainty in general. That's the best way I can describe it right now.
I'm curious to know if you've had much feedback from your colleagues, your tennis playing colleagues, whether on the council or not, about how they feel about coming to New York in August.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, at least half think it's crazy that we're even considering this. And then you have still a lot of players that would probably play under any circumstances or any conditions or any cost, because this is their livelihood. So they don't mind, you know, whatever restrictions are in place. But then other players are putting, you know, their safety and the safety of their team member or members ahead of, you know, the financial aspect of it, right? They're putting their well-being ahead of the financial aspect of it. So it's just kind of a debate. You know, a lot of the times I think athletes are seen as just like, well, just go play. Whatever is asked of you, just go play. But at the same time, I feel like anybody who is working in an environment that where there are fundamental things they don't agree with, like, do you just up and quit? Like, or do you try to, you know, create some kind of meaningful change first? I would hope that people would, you know, try to have the discussions and have the conversations where you can create meaningful change, you know, that's kind of overlooked maybe at the current moment. So I think it's kind of an all-encompassing issue in terms of the way that athletes are seen, in terms of the way that the business functions. You know, there are a lot of different elements in play right now.
Well, does it help, you think, that because the USTA made this announcement 9 weeks out, that they may have time to think about things and maybe come up with a better solution?
I mean, that would be my hope, especially just because the amount of players that are very concerned is like pretty staggering. Like, when you have like around half of the players that are, you know, really, really concerned about traveling to the US and the possible consequence of testing positive and just all of these issues and not having qualifying and all this different stuff. Like, I really, really hope that they could make some changes. So far, it seems like a lot of it is set in stone. But I mean, you never know. Like you said, there's still 9 weeks or 8 weeks now or whatever it may be. And I hope that they can consider making some changes, because I think it would make it better for a lot more players if they could, which is the goal.
Gabby, on the surface, you would think that a lot of the European players who are on the fence might not jump over that fence, given that the French Open at Roland Garros is scheduled to start a week after the end of the U.S. Open, so toward the end of September. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a legitimate concern, that maybe the top European players might not want to take the chance?
Yeah,
or any others, for that matter.
I've gotten some feedback like that for sure, where they're just like, no, I don't feel comfortable traveling to the States. I would rather stay in Europe and prepare for the French Open. But in that case, you know, then if you're missing a lot of the European players, is like, how do you then protect their ranking? Because obviously these are unprecedented times and people should have, should be able to travel to a tournament of their own volition and not be penalized, you know. But all the tournaments, this is the thing, we were hoping that at least the US Open could operate without ranking points, so that even if whatever field comes to the tournament, that the players that didn't feel safe traveling were not impacted negatively with the ranking. So now we have to look at possible solutions of frozen rankings for players, or, you know, different creative sort of solutions in terms of that. But the thing is that ranking points are tied into like TV contracts.
Exactly.
So if the rankings are removed, then that means the contract can be renegotiated. And of course that would mean less money for the USTA US Open.
Right.
So I understand that they don't want to operate without ranking points, but then at the same time, we're creating these discrepancies in the rankings that we already have. And so, you know, it's a difficult problem to solve, really.
I have to ask, how much about this business stuff did you know? I only just found out last week about the ESPN contract tied into rankings points. How much of this business stuff did you know before you were involved with the council?
Oh, not a lot. You know, it's not like they like publicize the info. If you were to ask, somebody would tell you, which is fine. They don't need to publicize all this stuff.
Right.
But it's definitely been very eye-opening, to say the least.
Do you get the feeling that a lot of players are interested in this sort of thing and, you know, would want to be a part of the behind the scenes, or are more of them inclined just to show up to play when they're supposed to play and let the financial stuff take care of itself?
I think the majority, you know, just want to focus on their tennis. I had even a player last year when I was going around getting feedback for some stuff in the fall. She was like, are you sure, like, you want to be doing this? Like, doesn't this take up a lot of your time and effort? And I was like, I mean, yeah, it does, but I care a lot. And so I don't mind doing it. You know, it's tough. It's the last couple of months have been like having a part-time job. It's except one that you don't exactly get paid for,
right.
But that's okay because I'm getting paid and hopefully making a positive difference. So at the end of the day, it's very rewarding. But at the same time can be very frustrating because the business side is so prevalent, and I'm very much about, fairness and justice. And, so sometimes those lines, you know, when they cross, it's not the right outcome that, you know, I would be looking for.
As a union guy and a shop steward myself, I could not agree more with your philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tricky part is tennis players aren't unionized, and we're apparently technically not allowed to. So
right.
It's like, what do you do? The only thing we have, like at WTA and now more recently at the ITF, is like ITF created a player panel. So at least they have some representation, where not that they have any voting power, but at least they can talk to the committees, who then talk to the board members, who then vote. And in WTA, we have council.
Right.
And I feel like we're all equally asked for our feedback, and we've been really fair, all of us, from top to bottom, no matter what the ranking is. I'm actually really glad to be working with this group of girls, because I think they all bring a unique perspective to the table, and they're pretty open to listening. We're open to listening to each other and hearing what we've got to say. So, you know, it's worked out pretty well, and I think we've been very fair so far. And also the WTA, I think, has improved their communication with the players tenfold to what it used to be. You know, we have weekly meetings with all our full members and associate members, So at least, you know, the majority of the WTA players are getting some kind of insight on what's going on and have the opportunity to ask questions and give their feedback and all this stuff. So I think things are, you know, they're moving in the right direction overall.
I would absolutely be remiss, so I will be sure to ask you about this. We've been talking about the player councils a little bit. There is a very high-ranking men's player from the ATP Player Council who is hearing, I don't know if he's listening to them, but he's hearing cries for him to be removed from the council. I'm talking about Novak Djokovic, former U.S. Open champion, who hosted a tournament in Serbia last week, was seen on video, YouTube, Twitter, other social media platforms, dancing up a storm with some buddies in a club. And it turns out, we found out the last couple of days, that two of the players who were involved in that tournament, Grigor Dimitrov and Borna Coric, have both tested positive for COVID-19. As outspoken as you are on so many of these issues, Gabby, I'm wondering what your take is on everything that's happening with Djokovic and the two guys who've come down with COVID.
Oh, man, yeah, that's tough, because I understand wanting things to come back to normal as quickly as possible. Like, I get that. But at the same time, I think that shows actually how easy it is to contract the virus when you are I don't know. I think there were photos of like lots of hugging and like the soccer match and, like you said, the partying. So I feel like when you put yourself in that kind of a situation, there is a risk right now. You know, we are still having like a global pandemic. Like, it hasn't gone away yet, unfortunately.
Exactly what Andy Roddick said on Twitter, I think this morning or last night.
Yeah, it's...
By the way, there's a global pandemic.
Oh, I love Andy Roddick. Yeah, I love Andy Roddick. I think he's so clever. Yeah, so it just seems a little premature to have taken that big of a risk under those conditions, like to have all the fans there and the kids' days and stuff like that. Like, believe me, I get that they want to do something good, and probably overall it was amazing for most of the people there, let's say, or for their tennis economy and getting people back into it and stuff like that. But at the same time, you have to weigh the risks, and now we're obviously learning of the risks, and then what does this mean going forward? You know, it affects more than just the people who even got COVID. Everybody who was around now is at risk, and now everybody has to think of how the tour should move forward and how can we learn from this situation. And I know the tours aren't trying to move forward with any kind of like not encouraging parties or
right
hugging. Like, they're encouraging social distancing. We're looking at lots of testing and immediate isolation, you know, which is also, you know, extreme to the other side, but that's the only way that they would probably be allowed to operate, which is totally fair in these circumstances. But that's the thing. I mean, who knows how they even caught it? Like, was it from the hug? Was it from the party? Was it from playing tennis? Was it from interacting with the fans? Like, what even was the thing that caused it? We don't know. It's really hard to retrace those steps when you come in contact with so many different people. So it's just a tough situation. Like, I just think it was too early to try something like that right now, you know?
Right. Now, I want to turn this back, if you don't mind, briefly to the U.S. Open and the announcement last week that the tournament will go on schedule, that players will be put up in the TWA hotel at Kennedy Airport, but also to sort of expand the bubble, if you will, those players who have the means, the resources, will be able to rent out private homes as they've done in the past. And I'm wondering, for a player who's so involved in the behind the scenes, such as yourself, what are your thoughts on that bubble not being so tight a bubble?
Well, that's kind of what I was talking about before, is like, when you have certain players of a certain ranking that express their concern with the conditions and the protocols that have been put in place, then immediately you're seeing a change of heart
in those very strict rules that we had heard about 2 weeks ago, where you're only allowed in the hotels and you're only allowed on site and you're not allowed on site longer than a certain amount of time after you practice, like on a practice day, not on a match day, and like all these things. And so now we're seeing some of these things being loosened, and then you really just wonder what would be the consequence of that. Because if you are not staying in a hotel, I mean, even if you are staying in a hotel, like how do you enforce a bubble, really? You know, like if people are going to want to leave, it's not like they're going to be stopped to leave. If people are going to want to take a taxi into Manhattan, I'm sure they're going to do that anyways, if that's something they really want to do. So it's just, I would hope that they wouldn't, but that's what I'm saying is like, I could be doing everything I can, but then I can't control the other people around me. So it's just really tough to try to get this thing right. And I just don't want to see, you know, holes in the draw because people have been testing positive. I don't want,
whether legitimately or not, right?
Whether legitimately or not, like there's just so many things that are up in the air right now. I don't know what the best way to move forward is. I mean, I have my own opinion on what I would love to see, but at the same time, I don't want to hurt tennis with anything. So, you know, I'm not a business person. I want to understand even more than I've already learned in the last few months. But I would just like to see like some more creative solutions on how we can get through this time without creating gaps in the rankings, without putting players' health and their team members' health and well-being at risk. Because that's really what it would come down to at the end of the day, is even if, like, we don't know what COVID does to you for sure. We there are some people who are young and healthy and who would still potentially suffer from a lung condition or heart condition later on. You know, it's not only old people that are very sick that are dying. Like, you still have other cases in certain situations. You know, when we travel, our immune systems are compromised already. So not to the extent of like a disease or anything, but just like our immune systems are not operating on high. They're operating on low with all the travel that we do. If we could come to one place and stay there for 2 months, yeah, I would much prefer to see that than going from the US Open to Madrid, Rome, Paris, Asia, Europe again. You know, like it's the schedule is very tough for me, in my opinion, like to really execute in the safest way possible, the way the world is right now today.
While we've been talking, I checked the calendar. It's exactly 10 weeks from today to the start of the U.S. Open on August 31st. So given that you have 70 days, if everything stays the way it is in terms of New York continuing to flatten the curve and the case numbers go down and the positive test numbers go down, how inclined are you, Gabby Dabrowski, number 7 women's doubles player in the world, to be here when the competition starts and to be playing in the field?
Yeah, that's a really good question. If everything, if the world is clearing up, if maybe the consequence of testing positive is not, you know, an immediate removal from the tournament or something, if maybe you're only if you're very symptomatic, not asymptomatic, I don't know. It really depends on the information that we're able to learn within the next month or two, then I'll be able to decide better. Because as it stands right now, it just seems very, very risky, not only for me, but for others around me, where I travel to, and then the consequence of testing positive and just having to be in isolation until you test negative, which could be weeks on end. You know, I have a friend, he tested positive 3 times in 5 weeks with almost no symptoms. I'm just thinking for myself, oh man, what if I test positive and I'm stuck in a hotel in a city and I can't even go home because I have to wait till I test negative. And it's just, I'm trying to like wrap my head around it, but I can't wrap my head around it right now as it stands. Like,
so if this was a decision that had to be made in the next few days or even a couple of weeks, where would you be pointing? Which direction?
right now, I'm like today, I'm pointing towards no. But if things loosen up and things open up and things are better in 2 months, then yeah, it's fine to play. But at the same time, I'm extremely against playing with ranking points, and I will be working really, really hard to make sure that anybody that's not able to play doesn't suffer in the rankings, and that like the best possible solution can come for them, whether that be for me if I don't play, or for others if they don't play or they can't play. Because this is another issue that we're seeing, is some governments are not opening until September or October. So how do the athletes get out of the country, you know? And then other countries require, like Australia requires a 2-week quarantine, which costs like $2,800 or $3,000 for when you come back to Australia. So it's not even, you know, a cost of coming to a tournament, but then possibly going home and then not being able to even be home for 2 weeks at your own expense. So it's like, there's so many different factors to take into consideration, like visas for players. What happens if you can't get a visa on time because the visa centers are closed? Like, I'm sure the tours are working hard to help these players, but I don't know how much, you know, power they'll be able to have at the end of the day with this type of a world situation.
Yeah, you bring up some really good points. Hey, before we wrap up, and I really do appreciate your time, I've got to ask, how did you get into tennis growing up in Canada?
Kind of by accident. Nobody in my family plays, which is a bit rare, I think, for tennis players. Usually it's like a parent or a sibling that have played or coached or something. And so I was 7 years old, and it was the summer when both my parents were working. So one of my dad's best friends flew from Europe with her son, who was 3 years older than me. So he was 10, I was 7. And just midsummer, and we were kind of bored. She was trying to teach me to speak French because she was living in Paris and they're Polish. So I was like speaking Polish, speaking French, speaking English. And I was just kind of tired of that. I wanted to have more fun. And so I was like, hey, Christian, which is her son's name, like, you want to go to the park? And so we went to the park and we played some tennis, and, or we tried to anyways. And then, you know, things just kind of kept going. Then you take lessons in the fall, and then it starts at like 30 minutes a week, then it's an hour a week, then it's twice a week, then it's three times a week, then you do all the kids clinics, and you start traveling for tournaments, local, provincial, national, international, and it just keeps going. So yeah, humble
beginning. 20 years later, here you are.
Yeah, I'm still going. Somehow.
When did you know you were going to be good enough to give it a shot at professional?
I don't think I'd be able to pinpoint an exact age, but I mean, I'd won like under 14 provincials in Ontario. I won under 18 nationals in Canada. So then you start thinking, okay, what's next? And you start going internationally and then winning a couple junior tournaments. So I'd say probably early teens, where there was like a pretty good indicator that this was something that I had potential in.
And how did your road, your path, take you onto the doubles track?
In my early 20s, I was about floating around, let's say like 200 in the world in singles. So like I was making slam qualies, which was great, but like I wasn't passing more than one round, and basically running out of money couldn't afford a coach to really make me better. So I was kind of traveling solo or traveling with my dad and just kind of, I guess, winging it, if you will. And, but then there came a point where that really wasn't good enough. And since I couldn't afford a coach, I had to kind of figure things out, because it was either like, you're probably either going to need to stop or you need to get creative. And so I chose to get creative because I had a good double skill set and I'd always done well in doubles tournaments. So I just pursued that instead. And of course, your goals as a tennis player are to, you know, represent your country internationally, whether it be at Fed Cup or Olympics or Grand Slams or do well at Slams or all the big tournaments, all the Masters, you know, our premier mandatories, we call them on WTA. And then I just worked my way up. And as I worked my way up, was fortunate enough to play with some really amazing partners who helped me along the way, and then gained some more exposure and respect. And then when other players respect you and know you, then they want to play with you, and then you're able to do better. And And it just kept going. And then I fulfilled all my goals. So, yeah.
Fantastic. And you partnered last year to most of your really good results with Yifan Xu. And now are teaming up with Yelena Ostapenko.
Yeah. She's an incredible player, really hard hitter from the baseline. So she can set me up really well at the net. And that's where I love to be. So I'm looking forward to hopefully playing with her more.
I'm hoping that we get to see you in Flushing in late August, that everything will pan out and allow you to make the trip. I'd like to wrap up on a sort of a, I don't know if it, I saved this question for last because I figure if you're going to get upset and we're going to call things off, then this would be a good place to do it. And I don't want to get you in trouble with anybody in New York, but Gabby Dabrowski, what's your favorite tournament?
The Australian Open.
Nothing wrong with that.
But you know, it's not just the tournament. Like, the tournament is great because they make improvements every year. They make us feel really special when we get there. We as players just like, there's an unspoken good vibe about that tournament. And for me, the city of Melbourne is one of the best cities in the world and somewhere I would hope someday to envision myself maybe living or spending more time in. I have a couple good friends there and, they live such a great and healthy balanced lifestyle. Really into sustainability and sustainable fashion. So like even when you're shopping, you can look for local brands, which I love, and they have so many great neighborhoods and foods. And also in Melbourne, which is really unique, is that downtown is 10 minutes away from the courts walking. And then I stay with my friends is like 15, 20 minutes to the courts walking. So it's such a good atmosphere. You know, the weather, well, some days can be really hot, but overall the weather is wonderful. You know, you have the beach, you have all different kinds of cuisines, and like the competition for restaurants is really high. So like if the standard of food is not good enough, you know, another restaurant will replace them. It's just a phenomenal place. And within an hour's drive, you have like Mount Martha, which is where one of my good friends lives, and beautiful beaches, like farmland. We went strawberry picking 2 years ago, you know, all this kind of really good down-to-earth stuff. And so I love it there. I really can't speak more highly of it, I don't think.
I was going to ask you, given your career or sideline as an advocate on the Player Council, if there would be a career in politics that might follow tennis, a career in Canadian politics. But obviously that'll be difficult if you're living in Australia.
I mean, yeah, well, I don't think I'm a good enough bullshitter to be a politician, to be quite frank with you, excuse my French, but I think you need to figure out a way to navigate all of the connections that and relationships that you seem to have to maintain, otherwise you don't get voted in. And I just honestly don't think with the way that I am and my ethics that I would ever be voted in, because I just don't agree with maintaining relationships with companies that don't hold themselves to a really high standard in terms of the way that they treat their employees, to the way that they treat the environment, so forth. So I don't really foresee that happening, but if the world changes in 20 years, yeah, maybe give me a shout if I get better at public speaking or something.
Well, you've acquitted yourself tremendously here today on this interview, and I appreciate it. I appreciate also your honest takes, both in this forum and on social media. As I told you in an email last week, I think you are one of the top tennis follows on the entire planet, and I expect that we will only hear and see better from you as the years progress. So thank you very much for all that you're doing, and I'm sure that your fellow players also thank you for your efforts on their behalf. As I get the freight train rolling by that I warned you would happen.
It's perfect. Thank you so much.
And the 5:50 train is always the longest one of the day.
Yeah, the rush hour train.
It's outstanding.
Well, thank you so much for listening and for your questions. I appreciate it.
I'm Mark Erday. She's Gabby Dabrowski, and you're On the Mark.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.